Ms. Beverly Stevens, who has been a many-time guest on the show and has now returned from a trip abroad with a bunch of young people who hold our future in their hands. Hi, Beverly. How are you?
Hi, Mike. I'm good. How are you?
I am, well, I was going to say I'm well, but I'm a bit disturbed by the events of the last 72 hours, as I'm sure you are.
Yeah. Everybody is, well, anybody who's thinking actually is.
Now,
the worst part of it, Mike, is that I actually happen to have, I mean, for me, I actually happen to have a contact within the group of international lawyers that's been trying to help both Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans. So I kind of get the real deal, not just the stuff that's being reported. And we've been sharing a lot of stuff on Facebook from other sources about what happened with Alfie Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to mention this, that the story's not over yet. That in fact, there's, and I can't really go into detail, but it looks like there's commonalities. Let's just say between the Charlie Gard case and the Alfie Evans case that people didn't suspect before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a theory that they've got some pretty good professionals looking to see if it can be proven. I would also like to say that I have a lot of experience with the UK. My son went to school there and university there, and I have, you know, many friends there for more than 20 years, and I've been there, I don't know, 100 times. I used to teach in East Anglia as well. So it's kind of hard for Americans to grasp this, and it's also hard for the Brits themselves to grasp this, but one of the things I point out, sort of in a humorous way, is it, you know, the English are not like Americans, for example. This is, America's a big place with a lot of different people.
Right.
We're more of a continent than we are a country, really,
right,
in a lot of ways.
Right.
And the Brits are, I used to kid my girlfriend, Elaine, who's obviously was from there, you say, you know, you guys are a tribe on an island. And you've got like a strict hierarchy, and you've got the royal family at the top, and then the rest of you all like sort of slot in the pyramid someplace. And she used to laugh and say, "Well, you know, there could be something to that." It's very hard for Americans to grasp the degree of conformity that's required in societies like that, and you know, because we get a lot of comments from Americans on Alfie Evans and on the Charlie Gard thing when it happened. What's the matter with you people? Stand on your own two feet, you know, like, and the Brits are sort of gobsmacked, if you will. They're sort of like,
they use that word too, gobsmacked.
Yes, and they get very, a few get very huffy. The rest get very mournful about the situation. It's, and they, you know, they're huffy because they're, you know, they turn to America's health system. Probably Alfie Evans would have never gotten, you know, any medical care at all. I mean, you know, this bullshit, like, it's just crap. But when you ask the question, why are you people, why won't you deal with something like this? They don't really have an answer. There's a lot of, you know, bluster and, oh, well, you know, and this is, you know, the child was going to die anyway, and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And there seems to be a great deal of unwarranted faith attached to their institutions, their legal and medical institutions.
Yes, yes, yes.
But you have to understand, again, we're talking about a tribe on an island.
Okay.
You know, that you don't, my friend Elaine once told me that she could tell in the first 15 seconds on the phone when she was working in banking in London with speaking to somebody for the first time, where they were from, approximately how old they were, how much education they had, and what social class they were.
That's a lot to get off out of a phone call.
It's 15 seconds. Okay, this is how delicately attuned they are to each other. And also why, when you notice when Brits come over here, they love America, love America.
Yes.
And I always laugh because it's partly because Americans love them. You know, I brought Elaine to my cousin's house and they were all like, will you talk for us? Will you just say something? You know, so there's, so that's another thing that, you know, they love, but they also love America because here, I mean, first of all, everybody assumes they're either a relative of the Queen or somehow related to the Beatles. So they get this kind of like, you know, sort of, they get this sort of aura around them in America. But also because in America, yes, we have a class system. There's no doubt about it. But it's much more fluid. And I dare any American to tell anything about very much about somebody else on the phone in 15 seconds. So it's not, we're talking, so the answer to the question, why won't they deal with this, is because it's like trying to get an insular tribe that you find, you know, somehow in a self, you know, I don't know, in the backwoods of some place, who are, they're eminently dependent on each other for survival, or at least that's the subtext that's there. So they don't step out of line. They don't, you know, the Brits have room for eccentricity in their culture, which of course, for example, the Germans do not. But a resistance, you know, I mean, look what happened to the Catholics in, you know, after King Henry dissolved the monastery. It was just literally in a place of relics in northern England last week. Unbelievable relics from the Reformation. Unbelievable relics from the Reformation.
Now you just saw them, you're saying?
Yes, I was just in this house that had all these relics.
Wow.
And there's also a map on the wall, and the map shows all the monasteries that were dissolved.
Mm.
I was gobsmacked. I was like, holy cow, they carpeted the country. There was 850 of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was basically what the man did, was he destroyed an entire civilization that was dependent on those monasteries. And the people who helped him do it grabbed everything. That was the deal.
Yes, yes.
And you kill the old abbot, you grab everything, you give me a piece of it, and the rest, you set yourself up as a local, noble, wealthy lord, because you'll have the rest. You'll have the lands, you'll have all of this. It's a fact of British history that to this day goes largely unacknowledged.
Well, they're embarrassed by it. My friend Joseph Pierce, you know Joseph. Joseph says, well, Marco, you know, we the British tend not to acknowledge things that are embarrassing to our lofty and elevated view of ourselves. So they don't acknowledge it because it's embarrassing.
Right. But it's also because of the fact that there's the legitimacy of their entire pyramidal society rests on not acknowledging this. You know, for whatever else you want to say about them, they have a sense of rectitude. And they are, you know, forever going on about, you know, the morality of this, that, or the other thing. The BBC does far more coverage of horrendous things that are happening in Africa and Asia and all these that Americans have any clue about. And that's because they are concerned with the morality of, you know, of these things happening.
I also pointed out to someone on Saturday that an English lass who was giving a friend of mine a gobsmack fit on Twitter kind of intervened, and she was, well, this is coming from you two, and from a church that enabled the Holocaust and did nothing to stop the Holocaust.
Well, now, here, this is an interesting thing. The origin of that particular myth comes from a book that was written by a man who my son went to school with his nephew. Okay?
Okay.
And it's what's really interesting, and my son gave me the backstory on this family. The nephew killed himself, all right, in his teens. And my son gave me the backstory on this family. This family is a Catholic family. The guy who wrote the Anti-Pius XII book is a Catholic family, very conflicted, a great deal of alcoholism, and a tremendous amount of like self-loathing in this family. Very wealthy, very well connected. Okay, so the reason this myth is abroad is because of this man. I forget the guy's name, writing this book in the 1990s. Now it's been proven 10 ways from Thursday that the book is absolutely without foundation.
It's garbage. Garbage. The BBC itself did an entire documentary on it and proved it was garbage.
But it's how you can get just sort of free floating calumnies out there, and it's one of the things that, again, one of the reasons why I started Regina, and also why I wanted to do these trips, which the trips always shock the people who go on them, always. And I don't mean to, actually, but I think that when they, like this particular, you mentioned the catacombs. We went to the catacombs of San Callisto.
I mentioned that because I knew you had been to them. So that was a lead in for you because you've actually seen them.
Well, I had never been in the catacombs before. It's not true that they're lined with skulls. There's an actual bone house that was run by an ossuary where those remains are. The catacombs, when you go at least down to the level that we went to, don't have any remains in them. But they are an astonishing experience in and of themselves. So they're carved out of tufa, which is a volcanic rock that's quite soft when it's first exposed to the air. So you can carve things out of it quite easily,
okay,
but very quickly hardens. So this particular catacombs, it's one of four major catacombs in Rome, goes down about 50 meters, and a half a million people are buried in it.
50 meters, half a million
meters.
People.
Right. It's unbelievable. It's like it extends out like a mile in either direction and goes down 50 meters.
Wow. That's incredible.
So the first two levels are there's five levels, and the first two levels are the ones that are open. And if you have claustrophobia, I would tell people not to go in there. but it's very eerie. You're walking through tunnels that are quite tall, that go up very high, and you're looking up, I don't know, looking up 20 feet in a tunnel, and there's niches carved in the tufa, which is now black. So your entire environment is black.
Okay.
And the niches are empty, but you have the definite sense you were way down in the earth. And what we did was we had arranged to have a mass down there, it was quite interesting because we had two priests along with us. We picked another one up on the way. Three great American priests, young priests, and with us, and they concelebrated at an altar in a family niche that was lined with all these cubicles, if you want, whatever you want to call them. We have photographs, actually, which will be in the next issue.
Okay.
And all the kids there, the ones that had rosaries, all put them on the altar. And we had three people with us who were not Catholic. Three Southerners. They're very interested, Southern Americans, who were very interested in the faith. It was kind of a shocker, I think, for... both the Catholics and the non-Catholics, to be actually present in the place where the early Christians are buried, or were buried, and to celebrate the Mass, which would have been the same Mass, or, you know, a later iteration of the Mass.
Right.
That was celebrated all the time in those catacombs. And then you know, trust me, after half an hour underground, the last thing, you know, what you, or maybe we were like 45 minutes, when you come up those stairs and go out into the clean, fresh air and the blue skies that are above you, you really want to be above ground.
You're glad to get out of there.
You sure are.
You're glad to get out of the catacombs.
So I think that for some of the people, there it requires, you know, the experience requires a fair amount of processing. Because, again, most young people, or most people in general, Catholic or not, are unacquainted with Christian history. They're not; it's not even taught to the degree that it was when we were kids. And so all of this is like, what? What happened here? You know, it's all history is like comes as a shocker.
And if it is taught, Beverly, Beverly Stevens, the editor of Regina Magazine, on the Dude Maker Hotline with us. If it is taught, they're getting an abbreviated, probably very biased Protestant version of it, and it's not correct.
For sure, yeah. In America, for sure. Interestingly, the trend that I can tell you that I know of across the West in the last 20 years, and I don't know of it because I do this sort of research, but only because of talking to young people, is not to touch on history like in more than just the most cursory fashion. I've stood in front of a group of Irish students who are like 19 years old and said, you know, there's 30 of them, and I say, so what do you know about the famine? Well, we know that there was one. Okay. When was it? One guy raises his hand. Mid-19th century. Very good.
There you go.
And what happened in famine? What percentage of your population died? No freaking idea, Mike. Just no idea. And afterwards I said to them, why don't you guys know this? And they say, oh, well, you know, we don't really concentrate on this. We concentrate on things like, you know, computer literacy. And so all these Western governments have decided essentially to abandon history as a study and basically in favor of making their children good little technocrats.
And do you know that right here on the Crusade Channel, we have a 3-part series that just completed last Wednesday of the Irish potato famine revealed of what really happened, which is principally that the same British that we're talking about that just basically executed Alfie Evans sent troops to Ireland, and at the end of a bayonet and the force of being executed by gunfire, thousands upon thousands of British troops confiscated the food from the Irish, because in England they had a mold, they couldn't grow potatoes, and basically caused the famine that your students that you stood in front of don't know about. It's one of the greatest historical revisions in history, that the Irish somehow wouldn't eat potatoes, and that's why they died. Who believes this stuff? Anyways, we've covered this extensively.
It's I laud you for doing so. What's happened across the board, Mike, is that people, in taking the history away from people, you take away their sense of identity, and you take away their sense of being rooted in a past.
Right.
And you take away their sense of, so essentially what you make them is rootless and easy to manipulate.
That's a good point, Beverly. You should write an article about that in Regina Magazine, because that's a really good point. And that's very important today, because you see the results of being deprived of history all around us in the Western world, don't we?
Yes, but we also see, and this is an interesting thing, we see it on a personal level, and it's not just a question of being deprived of history, it's being deprived of of a morality that generations upon generations of people handed down. So not only do the stories not get handed down, the precepts and the moralities are not being handed down. And so what am I talking about? Well, one of our retainer readers was informing me that his daughter is a life coach, I said, I'm sorry, what does that mean? And he said, well, she and her partner take people, young people, to Bali and to other places, exotic locales, to do life coaching sessions with them. And I'm like, what are we talking about here exactly? And then it turns out what we're talking about is kids in their 20s and early 30s
mm-hmm.
who have, you know, run into their first major disappointment in life. Relationships blow up, jobs don't work out, all the usual stuff that you hit in your 20s.
Sure.
Right? Which is normal, right? It's all normal stuff. But they don't have any way to cope with any of this. They don't have, and this is interesting because on our last trip, we actually saw this with some people who came along on the trip. And it was, you know, most of the people on our trip were very interested in the history and the spirituality and all of it. Then we had a small group of girls, and I say girls, they were women. They were like 30 years old. But they were, you know, there was a great deal of kerfuffle going on, and there was a lot of giggling, and then a lot of drama, and then a lot of drinking and all of this. And there was just this, you know, apparently people had, you know, gotten broken up with, and they were, you know, all upset. And when I've listened to this person talking about his, the daughter is certainly not somebody who's been a success at life, just put it this way. I mean, she's figured out a way to offer these coaching sessions and make money off of them, where these young people are, you know, confronting their challenges and yada, yada, yada.
All right, and, sure they are.
And all this kind of stuff. Well, mom and dad are probably supporting the bill to send them to Bali, but it is mostly girls that are on these things. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, what this life coach and I have in common is we're dealing with a certain, they're dealing with a much bigger subset. I have a small subset of people who are coming who have not been equipped by their parents or by their culture with how to deal with the inevitable disappointments of life. And it's you know, old-fashioned morality that came out of the Catholic experience protected women from the kind of disappointment that these girls inevitably must face. And I was talking to a young girl who was on our trip yesterday, and she was telling me that she has friends who she thinks this is all down to Disney princesses. And I said, I'm sorry. And she said, you know, if people are raised without any kind of culture or morality, then it's a vacuum. So what steps in is entertainment. So instead of religion, you have, you know, the way of the world as defined by Disney.
By Disney. Oh, what a horrid thought that is.
Well, it's quite true, you know. And if you look at these Disney stories, especially the later ones, they're all focused on a heroine. They're all the heroine, you know, overcomes great odds. And because she is smart and funny and resourceful and blah, 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 she gets the man who is the, you know, her true love and her soulmate and they live happily ever after.
Right, right, right.
And what happens is that these girls read into their own lives this experience you know, oh, I got me and Trevor, we're, you know, going to be together forever, and we move in together, and yes, I'm Catholic, but, you know, what does that mean? And, you know, and then Trevor gives them the heave-ho, and they find themselves age 30. Oh, my gosh, what's happened to me? And
then you, okay, so you have, just recently now, you have, not only is it Disney, though, Beverly, and Beverly Stevens is the editor of Regina Magazine on the Dude Maker Hotline with us at reginamag.com, and I want to ask you a question about your lead story today. But it's not just Disney, because in the publishing world, look at the books that are popular these days, or in the last 10 years, like when my daughters were growing up, and they're 21 now, what were they reading? They were reading Harry Potter. They were reading the dystopian hits like The Hunger Games and the Twilight series. Who are the Luke Skywalkers, if you will, of those books? They're all girls. They're girls. They're all heroines.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that in reality, this entire push towards making women see themselves as the protagonist in their own drama has immensely bad effects, because what it does is it prevents them from noticing what's really going on around them, and it prevents them from understanding their actual vulnerabilities, so that when Trevor dumps them, they are, in many cases, completely shocked. Or when Trevor turns out to be, a secret porn addict or whatever. I mean, the stories over and over the same thing.
Yeah, I've heard them too.
The girls are just like, you know, and then the next step in the progression is men suck. Right, so then they're awful and they're blubbery, but you know, and all it does is set women up for bitterness and a repeat cycle of bad choices, which lead to even more trouble.
Now, before we run out of time, though, I want to ask you about, because let's tie this in. You have a story at Regina Magazine called "Tom Evans, Millennial Working Class Hero." So we have a young man who's actually trying to, by all accounts, trying to do the right thing, trying to save his son's life. I assume at some level, trying to get Jane to marry him and to make the family official. Tell me what's in the story of Tom Evans. Kate, I keep saying Jane. Why in the hell do I keep saying Jane? Kate.
Yeah.
Yes, Kate. Well, what's in the story?
I don't know what the personal details are of these people's lives vis-a-vis marriages, but I can tell you one thing in general.
Okay.
And that is that in Europe, almost nobody gets married unless they're wealthy. It is becoming very quickly an institution that is only for the rich.
That's interesting. And that's shocking.
And it's also, you know, you'll see fancy wedding venues, and you'll see all kinds of, you know, like castles and everything else all set up for people to have these elaborate weddings. And you think, well, they must be getting married, right? But it's not the 25-year-olds who are getting married. It's the 45 and 50-year-olds who are getting married. And they're getting married because this is, for whatever reason, the second marriage, third marriage. And it's all about the party. You know, it's all about the party. It's all about the spending the money and
the reception
and the reception and the having the big party. And that's why so many young working class people simply cannot afford the big party. So they, rather than not than embarrassing themselves, they don't bother getting married. So the concept of marriage as a sacrament
It's gone.
Right out the window.
It's gone. Well, you know, what did Our Lady tell the children and Sister Lucia after Fatima? That the attack was going to come on marriage and the family. And then to Our Lady of Akita, She said the same thing, and that it's going that the force of the attack was going to accelerate, and it would get so bad, Beverly, that the living would envy the dead.
Yeah. Well, it's a situation where the notion of marriage, or a family, what's happened in our lifetime is that huge swaths of what used to be Christendom, it's devolved to a matriarchy, to the degree that women are even having babies at all. So you have people who are, the only authority in the family is female, and the men are sort of floating out there, sort of extraneous.
Well, Beverly, this is also the theme of your book.
Yeah.
The book that you published, The Devil Hates Latin. I mean, I finished reading it now, so I can tell people.
Oh, did you really?
Yes,
tell
I did.
What you think?
So I liked it. I liked it. It's very accurate. But that's one of the sub themes in the book, is they don't know what marriage is, and that girl doesn't know. She's searching for it. She sees her parents, and she goes, and she knows that there's something called marriage. But it doesn't really exist in Italian society, as you've told me. Now, you just came back from Italy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, has it gotten... Now, Hillary White tells me that, Mike, she tells me in private correspondence, Italy, you cannot recognize the Italy of today and reconcile it. Yesterday, we celebrated the feast day the correct rite. We celebrated the feast of St. Peter of Verona. I read Butler's write-up on it. It was 4 pages long. What a life. What a life this Dominican had. There's no way that St. Peter of Verona, who was ordained at 16 years old by St. Dominic himself, came from the Italy that I read about in The Devil Hates Latin and that I hear about that is actually part of Italy today. Can you confirm that it's gotten that bad?
Well, I would say overall, yes. I would say that... There are certain pockets in the culture where ideas of decency and so forth linger. The Italians are convinced, sadly, that really they're not any different than they ever were, and that the faith is something that is cultural and just part of who they are, and it's in no danger of going away. And I would say up until this Alfie Evans thing, mm-hmm. honest, I think this really is it may well be a sea change. They're the beginning of one as far as the Italians are concerned. The Italians very much look up to the Brits, and they see them as being, very modern and very successful and very yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of Italians, young Italians, working in Italy. I mean, in Britain.
Well, the British kind of like the Italians, too, because they stole the Genovese flag and made it the Union Jack, so...
Well, I think the British are actually...
Or borrowed it,
rather. They mainly like, areas of Tuscany. They refer to it as Chianti Shire, where,
Chianti Shire!
Yeah, where they can go and have villas and so forth and pretend to be Florentine aristocrats from 400 years ago. But anyway, I would say, to your question about the Italians today, I think that they've been living in an illusion. And I think this Alfie Evans thing is quite interesting because it's awakened a number of Italian intellectuals. It made them say, wait a second, because I've seen this on Facebook. Wait a second. Why couldn't the English see the immorality of what they were doing? We know that what the right thing to do is to give this child another chance,
sure.
any other chance. And why wouldn't they know that? what is the problem here? And it may be, I don't know. I mean, I may be naive here, but it may be that they'll start to ask the question, why is it that we know in our bones that what they did was wrong? And they don't seem to get that. So I would say that there is hope for Italy to the degree that people start asking that question. I would also say that, you know, Italy is extremely hard to govern. It's a very big, long country, and it has been traditionally a difficult place to govern. In a way, sort of like America is. It's spread out, different people encountering different kinds of things, and there's the Italians, unlike the Brits, are not a very conformist society, and so there's a you know, so when you're talking about your observations of one part of Italy, I don't know that that would hold true at all in other parts of Italy.
Right, and this is I have friends who have lived like you have in Italy, and they tell me Italian food, that's a joke. There's Sicilian food. There's Bolognese food. There's Milanese food. There's Genoan food. There's no such thing as Italian food in Italy.
The food thing is interesting, though, because a friend of mine lives in Florence, and she speaks Italian fluently, and she was saying to me, you know, when you overhear the Italians talking, the Florentines talking these days, all they ever talk about is food. And I said to her, is it because they're trying to avoid any other subject? And she said she had the distinct impression that that's true. That so much of their culture has now been disrupted. There's deep disagreement about a lot of things. But the Italians, you know, the other thing that's they're very good at smoothing over ruffled feathers. That's their thing. Mm. They just want everything to keep running smoothly, you know. And so you're not going to get a lot of resistance to ideas. They'll pretty much, oh yes, well, you disagree, and let's talk about the kind of ravioli we're going to have today. I mean, that's just part of their culture. I think, honestly, this may sound odd, but the fact of the matter is that the church worldwide has, in most areas, given up her position of leadership. She has relinquished her.
Oh, there, Beverly, there's no doubt. Look at what the Archbishop of Liverpool said to Tom Evans. He didn't even know that the man was baptized in his own church. And then loading praise on Alder Hey, we did a little research into this and discovered that for over two decades, Alder Hey Hospital was harvesting baby parts, was selling vital organs. No investigation was ever made into the conditions of the children's death, but thousands upon thousands of thousands of parents buried empty caskets or were given urns that had goat ashes in them. I mean, it's a huge controversy here. And then you have the Archbishop and the Archdiocese of Liverpool loading praise on this hospital. And again, your friend and mine, Joseph Pierce, tells me, well, compounds the embarrassment. But Pierce also told me, because he went back home last summer, he told me that, because we talked about Our Lady of Walsingham, because I would have been praying my rosaries for little Alfie and for Tom and Kate to Our Lady of Walsingham. And he told me that, and you've been there, I think, recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He told me that, well, Michael, Our Lady of Walsingham, of course, the English don't use the H, Our Lady of Walsingham, is making a comeback. He said there's a great reason for hope in England, that the pilgrimages have resumed, right?
Yes. Well, actually, that's part of what we're going to be doing when we do the Regina trip to England at the end of August. That's what we're going to do day two, is that we're going to be on that pilgrimage.
Oh, I so want to go, but I'm too old. I'm too old.
No, you could go. Absolutely could go, Mike. I would be pleased to have you come along. It is, we're going to do that day. I think there's going to be like a 10-mile walk in the schedule. And it's going to be, what I really am looking for is the experience of, the Americans and other English speakers that we're bringing with us to walk those beautiful, gorgeous roads of East Anglia and to listen and to watch and to see, because it's young people in England who are taking up this banner. It's really, you know, in all the bad news that we talk about, there is a definite undercurrent of very brave young people who are Catholic, who are converting to the faith,
mm-hmm.
who are saying, who are not even engaging with the culture. They're just living their own lives, and I guess that's how the Holy Spirit works, because, you know, you see these questions, like, I talk to them and I ask them, so, what would make you decide to, I don't know, become a nun? I remember sitting with a group of young novices, girls, they're 25 to 30 years of age, and they're telling me about their lives and their friends and everything, and the backgrounds that they come from. Would in no way, Michael, this is not anything, it's not like they come from super devout, you know, Catholic families with 9 kids. Some of them do, you know, but a lot of them don't. A lot of them come from, like, you know, indifferent raising and indifferent backgrounds and whatever. Their friends aren't devout. I'm like, what are you doing here? How did you, how did this happen? And they say, they'll tell you, you know, they don't even know. They say it's like, well, it's like falling in love. It was just an emotional decision. I wanted to do this.
Somebody asked me the other day, we have a mutual friend who attends St. Jane de Chantal Parish Noon Latin Mass that I go to. And she told me, she said, Patrick's been working on, because they work together, he keeps nagging me about going to the Latin Mass. You got to come to the Latin Mass. You got to come to the Latin Mass. You got to come to the Latin Mass. She goes, and she's intimidated. She goes, I'm scared to death because I don't speak Latin. I don't even know how to read it. I told her, I won't give her a name. M. Let's call her M. M, get over that. Don't worry about it. Come to the first Mass. Don't even pick the hand missile up. Just watch it. Just pray and watch it. Maybe on the second or third, you pick the hand missile up, and then you see what the instructions are. Just follow when people are kneeling. Don't try to follow along. Just watch it. And I said, after you've gone 4 times, if you give it 4 tries, I guarantee you that you're going to be able to identify there's something seriously different from the new Mass that you've been going to. And there's going to be a reverence, a solemnity, and a charitable act of love and devotion, adoration, if you will, that's going on during that Mass, especially around and then after the consecration. And you're going to see people that are imbued by the Holy Ghost, of what's actually going on in that Mass, which is a reenactment of Holy Thursday. You're going to see how seriously